From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Happy 4th of July. In honor of America's birthday, we're going to listen back to some of our favorite conversations about other great inventions. From the World Wide Web.
The idea was that it could put anything on it. I never imagined that it would kind of have, like, everything on it.
To Spanx.
I had them on under my cream pants and came out and showed her, and she went, oh, wow, I get it.
To police detectives.
One of the first detectives was a former fireman who firemen were considered very out of control. And another one was a convicted criminal.
And Marshmallow Fluff.
You just can't talk about fluff without giggling and laughing, and it just invites conversation.
Great inventions, next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and a happy 4th of July to you all. This day really celebrates an invention, the creation of America's experiment with democracy, ongoing and still imperfect 241 years later. Well, today we want to celebrate other bold inventions. So we're going to spend the hour listening back to some of our favorite conversations with the awe-inspiring, the revolutionary, the weird and wonderful founders and inventors we've had the pleasure of talking to. And what better way to start our hour than with the mastermind behind a world that consumes so many of our waking hours, a web that has enmeshed us all.
Thank you. My pleasure. It's a great honor.
Tim Berners-Lee, inventor of the World Wide Web. Yes, that World Wide Web. And technically, it's Sir Tim, for not only is he currently an MIT professor, Tim Berners-Lee has also been knighted by the Queen of England for his achievements. And when we spoke with him earlier this year, we started by asking the visionary if he could ever imagine, back in 1989, that he'd create something that today millions and millions of people and companies say with a straight face that they simply cannot live without.
Well, no, of course I didn't. I couldn't imagine that the project would be so successful. I mean, I had some projects which had been kind of successful that kind of worked and some that kind of didn't. So, no. It was designed, you know, I did call it the World Wide Web. It was designed to be universal. The whole point was breaking apart the silos of different documentation systems, if you like. And so the idea was that it could put anything on it. I never imagined that it would kind of have, like, everything on it.
Tim Berners-Lee is every bit the charming Englishman you're imagining right now. He's 61, and very much like a fountain of ideas, endlessly effervescing thoughts and questions, what-ifs and how might we's. Now, you probably want to know the creation story of the web, and we'll give it to you in just a bit, but hang tight, because first, how about the creation story of Tim Berners-Lee? He was born in England in 1955 to a computationally inclined family.
Mom and Dad worked on the first computer to be commercialized in the UK. It was built by Manchester University, and it was commercialized by Franti, the company, and they worked Franti on that team. It was ridiculously exciting, clearly. All the people that they brought home to dinner were all very excited about the idea of a computer because as a programmable thing. The fact that that really what it could do was limited by just the imagination of the program.
I heard you built a computer out of a television.
Yeah, and obviously a computer was a goal. And so the first part that I tackled was the input-output, the screen and the keyboard. So I found an old calculator which was semi-mechanical, which had just rows and rows of switches. So I grabbed that out of an old dumpster. And I was sitting right at the bottom of a huge dumpster, quite an operation, and took it home. And then I went down to the TV shop and I asked the guy...
Let me just jump in here for a second to say that the inventor of the web still exudes enthusiasm and excitement for that first computer he ever built, with a couple of old TVs that cost him less than £10. He spent several minutes of our interview walking us through all the details of its construction.
Now, I could have used the same technology of soldering together little integrated circuits to make a computer. I basically knew how to do it. But it would have been an awful lot of soldering. right, it would have been, you know, to build. You can build, the technology name is called TTL, transistor logic, and you could build a computer out of TTL.
All the way until he finished building the thing in college.
So by the time I was out of Oxford, finished my physics degree, I had this running in the living room, which was really exciting.
Berners-Lee graduated from Oxford University and eventually ended up in Switzerland at the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, home to the largest particle physics laboratory in the world. This is where the story of the World Wide Web really gets going, because in the 1980s, computers were everywhere at CERN. But they were all different models, running different programs, none of which talked to each other very well.
There's no rule at CERN. Everybody has to use the same sort of computer. So back then, 1989, that meant some people were starting to use these Macs and PCs. Some people were using mainframe computers, those huge things in the hall. Other people used mini computers. And so there was a massive diversity of different sort of computer. And then each one would come with its own way of keeping documents, storing documents, accessing documents. So if I wanted to find out about somebody's project, I'd have to go to their computer and learn some completely new documentation system.
Every single time.
What's wrong with this picture?
Well, everything, of course. And this is why I love the birth story of the web, because ostensibly, Berners-Lee starts off with a very humble goal. Get the computers at CERN to share stuff a bit better, using the existing infrastructure of the internet to link information. So in 1989, Tim Berners-Lee matched his seemingly humble goal with a humbly titled paper called Information Management, a Proposal.
But actually, they're just all looking at pages and clicking on options. And so, in fact, they could all be thought of as hypertext. If you build, if you think of a virtual hypertext system, you could actually imagine them all being part of this virtual hypertext system, and it wouldn't be that hard, in fact.
Tim Berners-Lee was about to change the world. But first, there was the matter of what to call his new information sharing system. He eventually settled on the World Wide Web, but there were a few other contenders.
I like Mine of Information, the idea, but the problem with that is it was moi. Just sounded a little egocentric. I could have made it the information mine.
Or Tim.
But that would have been Tim. I talked about mesh was because it was, the idea was it was a sort of a tangled mesh of all kinds of things. Sounded a bit messy. So mesh and mess were a bit close to each other. So World Wide Web, I liked because, first of all, when you're writing code in those days, it was really useful to start with a letter that people didn't use. So people, you know, one guy had written a whole system where it was called Zebra, where everything started with Z, so it didn't get confused with anything else. That was just a little practical thing. So I thought I could make it all W-based. So I called it WWW, and then there was having interviews about it. People would call and say, look, our spell check says that worldwide is one world. So it's actually W. Yours is, system is WW. It's not WWW. So I pushed back. Nope, it's WWW. World Wide Web are separate. that's just what it's called. There's a space between the world and the wide, so there. And that's how it's been.
But let's hop back to that humbly titled original paper, Information Management, a Proposal. Truth is, Tim Berners-Lee knew intuitively from the start that his relatively simple idea was about to change the world. And he describes it as a dream. Just a few years later, in a talk titled Hypertext and Our Collective Destiny, Tim Berners-Lee described, quote, a dream that the web could be an interactive sea of shared knowledge. He said, quote, I imagine it immersing us as a warm, friendly environment made of things we and our friends have seen, heard, believed, or have figured out. I would like it to bring our friends and colleagues closer. If misunderstandings are the cause of many of the world's woes, then can we not work them out in cyberspace? Berners-Lee said he wanted the web to become a realistic mirror,
or in fact the primary embodiment of the ways in which we work and play and socialize. And to that degree, it's been wildly successful beyond, you know, any measure, really.
Primary embodiment. Check.
Exactly.
Done that.
But the embodiment of how we work, play, and socialize also includes sort of the darker parts of the human condition. In other words, Sir Tim's dream has also turned into something of a nightmare. The dark side of social media, of fake news, of government surveillance, the loss of control over private information, all the ways in which corporations are once again siloing the information that Berners-Lee had wished to set free with the original open web. That is why on this, the 28th year of the World Wide Web, its inventor is advocating a radical overhaul of his own creation.
So here's what I've thought about this, and here's what I think about it. They've changed last year. So what I thought about that, and what I spent 20 years, the first 20 years of the web, telling people what you need to do, keep the internet neutral. Just give everybody unfettered, non-discriminatory access to the internet. Let people build websites. Let them link to each other. Good stuff will happen. And so we fought for net neutrality. We've got net neutrality. We have to fight. May have to fight for net neutrality again. I thought that all we had to do was to keep the net neutral. And then humanity, I have been quoted many times as saying I'm an optimist and I believe in humanity. And I believe that humanity will do the right thing. Now,
still, you're still an optimist.
I am still an optimist long term, but I think that we actually need to do a double take. We need to adjust our strategy. Those of us who feel the world can be a better place, can be more collaborative, that we can. Those original cyber utopian dreams that we will use technology to actually overcome national boundaries and overcome cultural boundaries and learn to love and get on with, collaborate with each other worldwide, they haven't actually happened. And so now when you look at the web, for one thing, for many people, it's remarkably like the pre-web. Do you remember America Online? AOL disks. They used to dial into AOL, and AOL would be their entire world of internet information. It would be email. It would be news. It would be entertainment. It would be games. And it was a walled garden. It was a silo, but it was valuable, and people paid for it and got value, derived value out of it. But the web came along, the just sheer crazy innovation and creativity on the web blew away any walled garden, and it has consistently blown away any walled garden since. But now people do look around and they look at some of the social networks and they see the same sort of thing. And but also when they look at people using these social networks, they see that in particular social networks, particular things happen, and people who design those social networks are stepping back and they're realizing, whoa, you know, we put in anonymity for the people and for the protesters and for the people who are protesting against oppressive regimes, but now we find it's being used by misogynist bullies, by nasty people who just get at being nasty. So now people who design those networks have to rethink how they're designed to try to make them into places where actually nice things happen.
Because just last month you wrote a paper saying the three things that you're worried about are loss of control of our personal data, that it's too easy to spread misinformation, and that political advertising requires or needs transparency and understanding. I mean, my just very brief question is, do you maintain the optimism that technology can be developed to overcome these problems, or do we need to look beyond technology to manage these?
I think technology always works hand in hand with law and regulation. So very important that we use both types of our brain to look at this, both the technical and the social piece to look at it in the future. Am I optimistic? Yes, because actually when you look at history, you know, crazy to imagine the web will just remain as it is. Everybody is right now looking at the way social networks are designed. They're changing them. They're trying out experiments. So people are designing new social networks all the time. People are designing new systems which are decentralized. So I am optimistic. But it's only going to happen because lots of people care about it very, very much. And that's not just people writing code. It's people writing laws. And it's people, random people, you know, teachers. And it's people in the street. The people listening to us have to care very carefully about this. And the amount of time Like, and when they have to step in and say, no, actually, this is a world I want. I don't want a world like that. I want a world like this. And I'm going to fight for it.
Tim Berners-Lee is the inventor of the World Wide Web. He's also director of the Global Standards Group, the World Wide Web Consortium, founding director of the World Wide Web Foundation, and professor at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. We spoke with him in April when he received this year's Turing Award. It's commonly considered the Nobel Prize for Computing. More inventors coming up. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. On this 4th of July, we're celebrating the inventing of America with a look at some of our favorite modern innovators and entrepreneurs, including the companies they founded and the fields they helped shape. Take Sarah Blakely. She's the founder and CEO of Spanx, the wildly successful shapewear company. Blakely is the sole owner of Spanx, and at 46, she is America's youngest self-made female billionaire. She also single-handedly revolutionized intimate apparel. Now, Blakely's story is legendary. Back in the late 90s, she was a 20-something door-to-door saleswoman who wanted something comfortable and form-fitting to wear under her white slacks. So she chopped the feet off a pair of control-top pantyhose, and the Spanx idea was born. All Blakely had at the time was a mere $5,000 in savings. But she had incredible, inexhaustible creativity, drive, and a superhero's immunity to rejection. Blakely cold-called manufacturers and retailers until she got her first big break. It came in 2000 when a buyer for retail giant Neiman Marcus agreed to meet with her in Dallas. When we spoke with Sarah Blakely last December, she told us Neiman's only gave her 10 minutes for that pivotal meeting. And from the start, she knew it was not going well.
Halfway through my pitch, I could tell I was completely losing her. I mean, she was just not, I could tell she was losing interest. She was so perfectly dressed, like her pen matched her dress that matched her shoes. And I had a Ziploc bag from my kitchen with my prototype of Spanx in it, Ziploc bag. I had my lucky red backpack with me, which was my presentation bag from college, which my friends begged me not to bring. They're like, you cannot go to the Neiman's headquarters
with the red backpack.
With the red backpack, but it was lucky, so I brought it anyway. And so I just said, you know what, excuse me, will you please come down the hall with me and come into the bathroom with me? And she just kind of shifted in her chair and went, okay. And I said, I'm just going to show you my product on me, like what it can do. And I went in the stall and I had them on under my cream pants and came out and showed her. And then I went back in the stall, took them off, came out in the cream pants without them. And she went, oh, wow, I get it. And this is brilliant.
And she decided to buy them right there, right?
She bought them right there. She said, Sarah, I'm going to try you in 7 doors and see how it goes. And I mean, I was out of my mind. It was the first place I'd cold called.
Yeah.
I didn't know anybody there. You know, I lived in Atlanta. I started with the Neiman's buyer locally down the street. And that's when they laughed and said, you need to call our buying office in Dallas. I was like, oh, okay. I didn't know you had a buying office.
But then I love it because your drive, I mean, it wasn't just that one moment, right? There was like a series of things even after that happened. Like I read that you wanted Neiman to see that Spanx could sell, right?
Yes.
So you kind of created your own little market at the beginning.
You have to. As soon as I got into Neiman's, I jumped into action to absolutely ensure success. I mean, no matter what I needed to do. So I did 2 things. One is I called every friend in those 7 cities or friends of friends that literally I hadn't talked to in forever and said, will you please go into Neiman's and buy Spanx and I'll write you a check. And so I was paying all of my friends and friends of friends to do this. And at the same time, then I went into Neiman's and stood in the department store from 8:30 until 7 every day around the country in those 7 stores. my biggest challenge was going to be, I mean, it was amazing that I got into Neiman Marcus, but my product was put in the sleepiest corner of the store, where it was in the hosiery department. And this product was for women that may never go into the hosiery department. So I recognized that. So I would set up a display table and stand in the entrance of Neiman's or by the shoe department and literally show people my product on me all day.
Without telling anyone at Neiman's, you would just do this?
Well, yes, because then everyone thinks someone else approved it. I mean, it's so important to just ask for forgiveness and not permission when you're starting out. You know, I just kept saying, I'm going to ask for forgiveness as long as I'm not harming anyone or breaking any serious laws. Like, I just need to do this because you always know the answer is going to be no.
I love every minute of this. I'm talking to you now, years after your company is wildly successful. You're a billionaire. I think Forbes said that you're the youngest female billionaire in America. So obviously you're successful and confident. Did you feel this kind of the confidence that you're projecting now? Did you feel that when you were in the earliest days of Spanx, when you were doing all these things and hoping to have to ask for forgiveness later?
It's such a great question. I mean, I think courage is a muscle, and you have to keep pushing yourself and putting yourself out there in order for it to get stronger and stronger. But I'm scared and nervous all the time. The nerves don't go away, and the feeling of stepping out of my comfort zone. But people talk about how Spanx started, but I had started doing work on myself long before I cut the feet out of my pantyhose. And I was around the age 16 when some really kind of big things happened to me all at once. And I started listening to Wayne Dyer, mm-hmm. How to Be a No Limit Person. Huh. And I started really taking to manifesting things into my life, the law of attraction, visualizing things, and really trying to free myself up from what other people think of me.
Yeah.
And as a woman, it really was important. I had to realize that not caring what other people think about me didn't have to mean I don't care about them.
Tell me more about that.
And that was a big pivot for me. You know, if you consume yourself with what other people think of you, you're going to hold yourself back in almost everything you do in life. And I just think we got one shot. It's not a dress rehearsal. Here we are. I don't want to hold myself back because I'm afraid someone might judge me or someone might look at me funny or I might embarrass myself.
This is so great to hear because obviously every entrepreneur takes risks, right? I mean, just by virtue of being an entrepreneur, you're taking risks. But I feel like the risks are even greater for women because oftentimes we've talked to a lot of them on our show where they say, you know, it's easy to hear that voice in your head saying no. It's easy to hear that voice in your head like anticipating the rejection. And that's why I love the foundation story of Spanx because it seems like you did the opposite of that. Like you might have heard that voice, but you just ignored it.
Well, that leads me to talk about two things. One is when I first thought of the idea for Spanx, I didn't tell any friends or family for 1 year. So I kept it completely private to myself and worked on it at night and on the weekends because I was still selling fax machines door to door when I thought of the idea. And I did that for one main reason is because out of love and concern, people will bring up things you should worry about,
right.
You know, and they're coming from the best place ever. But by telling people your idea or what it is, your dream or what you're wanting to do, you're just for validation, you're opening yourself up. And I didn't want to invite ego into the process so early on. So instead of having to defend my idea and explain it to a bunch of well-meaning people, I just quietly spent the time pursuing it. And I intuitively waited until the exact moment in my journey where I knew I wouldn't turn back no matter what I heard. And it was a year. And so a year into it, all my friends and family just knew Sarah's working on some crazy idea. She won't tell us what it is. But I was telling patent lawyers, and I was, you know, telling manufacturers, anybody that could help me move it forward. I just wasn't telling people just to hear if they thought it was a good idea or not.
Yeah.
And ideas are the most vulnerable in their infancy. The minute you have them, and it's human nature, in the minute we have them, to turn to our coworker, our friend, our husband, our wife, and tell them what the idea is. And when I finally did share the idea, I heard, well, honey, if it's such a good idea, how come no one else has done it?
Uh-huh.
And then I heard, you know, well, honey, even if it is a good idea, you're going to spend your $5,000 set aside in savings and the big guys will just knock you off in 6 months and, you know, put you out of business. And I think if I had heard those things right when I cut the feet out of my pantyhose to wear my white pants to the party, I'd probably still be selling fax machines.
Oh, jeez.
Or something else, because I don't even think fax machines exist anymore. But, you know, another thing is I was cold calling selling fax machines door to door for 7 years. And I heard nothing but no all day, every day. So it was just laying the groundwork and giving me really good training. But I definitely had my days where I'd get in the car and cry. I'd just drive around the block, cry. I mean, people would escort me out of their building and security guards would ask me to leave for soliciting. And I would get business cards ripped up in my face like once a week. I found that cold calling, I have so much respect for anyone who's ever done that.
So there's all sorts of challenges that an entrepreneur and a young company faces when they're getting off the ground. And then I suppose the challenges change as the company matures and grows. So like in the middle phase when, you know, you had you were in stores, your fan base, can I call them fan base? Your customer base was growing very rapidly. Sales were great. I mean, what were the challenges that you faced at that point in time?
Yeah, I fumbled my way through it. I've never taken a business class. I'd never worked in fashion or retail. I literally just had $5,000 set aside from selling fax machines and an idea and wanted to look better in my clothes and was super frustrated that the people that were making all of our undergarments were men, and nothing against men, but they weren't spending all day in them. So there was no motivation to make them more comfortable, make them fit better, make them work better. And asking so many whys, I was able to unpack that this industry had been on autopilot and was just making things the way they'd been made for 50 years without a lot of change to them. And so that's what Spanx did. It really kind of woke up a sleepy, tired industry. And I'm really proud that, you know, not only that I invented Spanx and it's made such a difference in women and how they dress, but that I raised the bar on comfort.
Hearing you say it, and after obviously so many millions of people affirmed it by being your customers, it's not rocket science. Like, why did comfort like get pushed out of the equation so long ago, right? It just like it took you to ask that question.
Yeah, I mean, the industry had been sizing all of their products on plastic forms.
And not, so they, not real women.
Right, not real women. So all of mine are sized on real women. I mean, I can remember very vividly when I leaned over and asked them all, ask her how she feels. I found out that they were taking an average waistband size between a small and a large and putting the same waistband on every product.
What?
In order to cut costs during production. So I said, time out. Like, a small gets a small waistband and a large woman gets a large waistband. That's ridiculous. And little thing, I mean, there was a tiny rubber cord in all of our waistbands and all hosiery products that didn't need to be there anymore. With the advancement of Lycra, the product could stay up, but no one had ever stopped to even say, you know, so I was like, take the rubber cord out. And they're like, well, it's going to slide down. Well, have you tried it? Let's try it. And then sure enough, it stayed up fine.
So what's next for you? I mean,
Meghna, I have so many things. I'm so excited. I have like a spiral notebook full of ideas. I have like 52 pages of ideas.
For the company or things?
Just in general.
In general.
A lot of them are inside of the company and a lot of them are outside of the company.
Wow.
I know. And I have 4 children under the age of 7. So I don't have that much time, but I feel very excited about life and I love trying to do things that haven't been done before.
So last question then, because
does that make me sound crazy? Maybe
no.
Just made me sound a little crazy. 50. I mean, maybe, well, I shouldn't have shared 52 pages.
Even if it did, maybe you have to be a little crazy to get as far as you have.
But they might not all see the light of day. I need more time, but I am excited.
I read, I think it was in the New Yorker, that when I'm jumping back and forth in time here, so forgive me, but that when the Spanx website was first launched, that your mom had a luncheon party or something,
yes.
And she accidentally, because of the name, directed people at the luncheon party to a completely different kind of website. Is that true?
Totally true. My poor sweet mom, she sent all of her friends at the luncheon to the wrong website, Spanx. So if you want to go to Spanx.com, I highly recommend you spell it with an X or you're going to get a real treat. Like my mom and all her sweet friends. She called me up. She's like, Sarah, all my friends are commenting about your new business. I'm like, Mom, how did you spell it?
It's the one with the X, everybody.
Yes.
Don't forget.
But you know what? I just joined social media. I have not been on any social media. I joined Instagram 6 weeks ago, Meghna. And listen, that was a fear of mine too, believe it or not.
So one thing which I always ask, can you tell me the story of a time where something didn't quite go right, an idea or a project failed, and you didn't anticipate that failure? And what was it, and how did you deal with it?
Well, the first thing comes up, and that was a little bit earlier in my journey, which was I'm a terrible test taker, and I wanted to be a lawyer, and I failed the LSAT.
I feel your pain.
Are you a bad test taker?
Well, I failed the LSAT.
I mean,
I didn't go on to found a billion-dollar company,
it's
though.
It's so hard, the LSAT. I don't know. I debated all through high school, all through college. Like, my major was legal communications. That was my path. And I took the LSAT and basically failed it, took the course, took it again, and failed it again, basically. I mean, my score was so low, I had to, like, was barely on the page. And so that was really a disruptive moment for me and my path, but life had other plans for me. And I often like to talk about how if you think you're failing at something, it's usually life's way of nudging you and just letting you know you're a little off course. And when I was growing up, my dad used to encourage me to fail. And I would sit at the dinner table and he would ask my brother and me what we had failed at that week.
Huh.
And if we didn't have something to tell him, he would be disappointed. And I can remember coming home and saying, Dad, I tried out for this and I was horrible. And he'd go, way to go, and high-five me. And what he was doing was reframing my definition of failure. So failure for me and my brother now is simply not trying versus the outcome.
That's fantastic.
So that was a big gift my dad gave me growing up.
Sarah Blakely is the founder and CEO of Spanx. We spoke with her last December. When we come back, two local inventions that changed law enforcement and sandwiches forever. Yep, said those two things in the same sentence. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're celebrating the founding of America with a look at some of our most unique and wonderful inventions. We've looked at how the World Wide Web has changed our society and how learning from failure led to a best-selling product. Now let's turn back the clock more than 150 years and examine something born right here in Boston in 1849, America's very first detective unit. Last year, we spoke to author Matthew Pearl. He wrote about the hidden history of these detectives for the Boston Globe magazine in a piece titled Into the Shadows. And he began by telling us the story of one of the first Boston police officers to plunge into those shadows, Detective Durastus Clapp.
I guess if you're named Durastus Clapp, maybe you just have to be a detective. It's sort of the perfect detective name. And the criminals who feared him nicknamed him Disastrous Clapp. He was the sort of senior member of this detective squad once he joined. At first, he resisted. He was a constable for many years before that, and he had a sort of side business. People would pay him to recover their stolen goods or to find someone who was missing. So he was already a detective in action before he became a detective in name. And the press loved him, the Boston newspapers. It was really only once Clapp joins the detective squad that the newspapers start to pay attention and actually give them some coverage. And he really becomes the unofficial head of this division.
Mm. And he goes after a particular criminal that the newspapers had dubbed Dazzle?
Yeah, Dazzle was a con artist. And this was really perfectly representative of society's fears at the time, which is that everything was getting more crowded, larger population, bigger buildings. Life was changing. It used to be that everyone would know each other. And suddenly there were people coming in, and it was very hard to keep track of who was who and who you could trust.
Yeah. As you remind us in your magazine piece, that Boston was a city of, what, 140,000 people at this time.
And right. And this was just very recently incorporated into a city, and what it meant to be a city. How do you have a fire department? What does that mean? And Boston was the first place to professionalize their fire department. So these things that we take for granted were really just coming into clarity about how they could function on a larger scale.
Yeah.
So Dazzle, whose real name was apparently Chauncey Larkin, would disguise himself as a naval officer. And because of the esteem people held the military in, store owners would give him merchandise on credit. He would buy weapons. He would have horse and buggies sort of at his ready all across the city, again, on credit. He once ordered 40 cases of liquor that he charged to the Navy.
So tell us a little bit more about the detective work that went into tying up the case of Dazzle.
One thing that was also new to the idea of policing that the detectives crystallized was the idea of surveillance. The detectives unleashed their network of informants, of stool pigeons, and began surveillance on the hotels, which is eventually what led them to finding a lieutenant registered at one of the large hotels in downtown Boston. Now, when they get to his room, he's apparently sick with cholera.
Mm-hmm.
Cholera was very poorly understood at the time, and first of all, you would be scared to get too close to someone with cholera. The other fascinating thing is that Detective Clapp's son had just died of cholera.
Which is weeks before.
Weeks before, right. And it was in the news. So my theory is that the con artist knew this, he read it in the papers, and he used that to sort of tap into Clapp's soft side, which you wouldn't normally know was even there, and it seemed to have worked because they called for a doctor, and by the time the doctor came, Dazzle had escaped. So they had to start the surveillance and the chase again, and eventually they tracked him down disguised as a minister at a boarding house, and they did capture him. With a fight, Dazzle takes out a knife. It was dangerous work already, and this was a time when the detectives and the police themselves were not armed.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We had seen this new approach to policing in reality, both in, Paris and London as well?
Just for a couple years before this. Paris starts being on the cutting edge of infiltrating the criminal element. And then London actually institutes an official detective bureau.
Mm-hmm. But we'd, as you point out in the magazine piece, we'd seen it even before that in fiction.
Right. And in the case of a French criminal turned policeman named Vidocq, he actually writes a memoir that becomes sort of a bestseller. And that inspires Edgar Allan Poe, who, of course, was from Boston, to create what is considered the first detective figure in literature, named Auguste Dupont, who later will inspire Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. who's obviously much more well-known today. So before the word detective would have been in the dictionary, it was already a figure that people were meeting in books and in articles.
Yeah. But when the Boston Police Force decided to create a detective unit, it wasn't necessarily met with cheers or open arms.
Right. People were very concerned that the ideas behind a detective unit were inherently corrupt.
Because they would have to be mixing with the, quote, criminal element.
Exactly. One of the tenets of detective policing was and still is the idea that you could go undercover, you could enter the criminal world or underworld, and people were sure that what would happen is that the detectives themselves would become criminals. And in fact, this fear was not helped by the fact that one of the first detectives was a former fireman who the firemen were considered very out of control, rowdy figures. And another one was a convicted criminal who had gone to prison and then a few years after he was released becomes one of the first detectives in the country.
It's so very 19th century in a certain way, questioning the moral rectitude of anyone who would want to become a detective for the, you know, these exact same reasons. And if they were going to be mixing with the criminal underworld, then certainly their own uprightness should be questioned.
Right, especially because one of the methods that the detectives would rely on was the informant network. Again, yeah. So many of these concepts are just integrated into our world today, both in actual law enforcement and in popular culture. But back then, this was a pretty shocking idea that you would have stool pigeons, a term that was already in use, that would be able to inform and interpret what was going on in the criminal world to these detectives. And people were very anxious about this kind of blurred line between the detective and the criminal.
But then, Matthew, in 1849, when Durastus Clapp and his team of new detectives used those very same techniques to find and capture the con man Dazzle, I mean, is that the case that turns public opinion in favor of detective work?
You know, it wasn't a linear progression in terms of the acceptance of the detectives. There were highs and lows. Certainly, Dazzle escaping from under their noses was a low point. Capturing him was definitely a triumph. I think the thread by which we see the detectives being appreciated in the public is that other cities begin to copy this model of Boston. Boston is the first to have this detective squad. And within a couple years, New York, Philadelphia, and Chicago have their own.
So, Matthew, this is something I really wanted to ask you about because you've written a number of books that take place, you know, in around this time period, the 19th century, because it's a really interesting era, particularly for Boston, right? You have, as we were discussing earlier, the growth of the city, the influx of immigrants, the long line of the old Boston families. There's also this sense of enlightenment and the pursuit of knowledge and understanding that, you know, in many ways for America took root here. So I guess what I'm saying is, does it surprise you or not that this sort of innovation in police work first took hold in Boston, in the United States?
Oh, yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. I think what might be more surprising is the fact that this history just got lost. Mm. Nobody has ever sort of traced the fact that not only were these the first detectives here, but the first detectives in the country and who they were and what mark they left.
Matthew Pearl is the author of several books, including The Dante Club and The Last Buccaneer. We spoke with him in 2016. And we have a link to his article, Into the Shadows. It's at our website, radioboston.org. A throwback there to a classic commercial on the joys of a fluffernutter sandwich. Because how could an hour on inventions be complete without a look at the founding of our deliciously weird New England staple? Earlier this year, we spoke to Mimi Graney, founder of the annual What the Fluff Festival in Somerville's Union Square. She's also author of the book Fluff, the sticky sweet story of an American icon. Fluff turns 100 this year, so we began our conversation with Graney by asking her about the origin story of the sticky treat.
Our specific recipe of marshmallow fluff was invented by Archibald Query in 1917. He was a French-Canadian confectioner. He had come to live in Franklin when he was 7 and then eventually settled in Somerville and was making fluff and selling it door to door. He had a home-based kitchen. And then during World War I, he had, because of sugar shortages, to shelve his product. And then another company took it up, Durkee Mower, who'd been making it since 1920.
I see. But even in those early days, I understand there was a fluff controversy in terms of there was a competitor or someone else who said that they had begun selling a similar product in 1910?
So there were a number of different marshmallow creams.
Okay.
So Durkee Mower's fluff has so taken over the market. People think that they are the only one. But there were a number of other ones. There was the Limpert Brothers in New Jersey had emerged later on when Marshmallow Fluff was looking to trademark the name. The Limpert Brothers said, "We have the name Marshmallow Fluff," and they eventually came to a decision to share the trademark. But back in the 19-teens, there were a number of different ones. For example, Snowflake Marshmallow Cream that was made out of Melrose, and that was the biggest local competitor to Fluff.
Okay, so before we get to more of the natural history of Marshmallow Fluff, I just ask you, I mean, you started the festival in Somerville. I mean, why do you love Fluff so much?
You just can't talk about fluff without giggling and laughing. And for a long time, I had known about Archibald Query inventing fluff. And as soon as I would mention, because I love sharing Somerville trivia whenever possible, people would just immediately start telling stories about, I have fluff in my cabinet right now. My mother wouldn't let me eat fluff and odors. It just invites conversation. So it felt like a great thing to bring people together in for a festival.
And where did the idea of putting fluff and peanut butter between two pieces of white bread come from?
So that was actually Emma Curtis of Snowflake Marshmallow Cream. She had initially actually lived in Somerville, so we can claim her as our own as well. But snowflake marshmallow cream. She called it a Liberty sandwich. She and her brother who ran the company were direct descendants of Paul Revere. So we're not sure whether she was naming it for their pedigree or because it was a tribute during World War I to limit your consumption of meat. So this was like a protein-rich sandwich.
With the peanut butter.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Now, so there's a very interesting historical and economic history to fluff here, because you write that Boston or the Boston area for a long time was really a center for confectionery production. And that's one of the reasons why fluff was able to get a foothold here, if I could put it that way.
Yeah. The very first commercial production of chocolate happened here in Boston with Baker's Chocolate. And then because of our transportation and our cool climate, it really made it possible for confectioners to operate their businesses. So at the turn of the 20th century, Boston was the number one candy manufacturer in the world, with giant factories with 1,000 people in them dipping chocolates and making caramels and toffees and all kinds of things. And because we had a number of major innovations in Boston as well. Granulated sugar was invented in Boston. The egg beater, the electric mixer, all the stuff I didn't know until I started here.
My face is like, wow. I mean, all this culinary innovation. Okay, so there's a couple more bits of the natural history here before we move forward to other aspects of fluff. Marshmallow eating actually dates back all the way to...
the Egyptians.
Ancient Egypt.
Yes.
I mean, that blew me away. Tell me about that.
So the origins of marshmallow is really from the marshmallow plant, and that root is very viscous, almost like the sliminess of okra. So back in ancient Egypt, it was mixed with honey and nuts and was food for royalty and for the gods. And then eventually it was used medicinally. So you would do that to soothe your throat and deal with coughs. And then because sugar was medicinal as well, let's add marshmallow root sap and sugar together, and apothecaries started manufacturing them as little tender pillows. And then they said, let's forget about the medicinal aspect, and they're just delicious.
Let's stop fooling ourselves, exactly.
Yeah, so then they started making them with gelatin, and they were incredibly popular. Sort of, if you think of like the 1970s fondue pot, in the 1920s, it was marshmallow toasting parties. The flappers would get together and have toasting parties.
Wow. What's your favorite way of enjoying fluff?
A big mug of hot chocolate with a spoon of fluff that just sort of melts. As a kid, it was really, the hot chocolate was a delivery device for the fluff.
That sounds like a good way of doing it. Now, there is so much fascinating history here, because in your book, you write about how fluff has a connection to the commercialization of radio. And, you know, given that we're radio people, we really have to talk about this. What role did fluff play in that?
So fluff started in 1920, and early radio stations were just emerging right after World War I as well. Previously, it was mostly used for military uses and by ships. And one of the first radio stations in the country, I also learned this, started in West Medford here in Massachusetts. And the radio then was, because they were using the public airways, was non-commercial. So because the radio stations needed to figure out a way to be able to pay the performers, they would have sponsors. And because they couldn't do a commercial, they would just name the performers after the products that were sponsoring them. So Fluff sponsored the Flufferettes, which was a radio performers. And that actually continued even once radio became fully commercial, all the way into the early 50s.
Well, we actually have a clip here that includes a couple of seconds from, or it is a couple of seconds of the Flufferettes. This is from the 1930s on WNAC radio here in Boston. So let's listen.
For something delicious, you know well enough, you will get your wishes with marshmallow fluff.
Tune in next week at the same time for more Flufferette Melodies. Your announcer is Hal Miller. This is the Yankee Network.
You know, overall, I'm kind of amazed that for a century, this product and this company has remained independent. It didn't get bought by any giant food conglomerate.
Not for lack of trying by the big bad Kraft company. Part of why Fluff owns the market now is because Kraft bought up a lot of those small businesses that were all those other marshmallow cream companies across the country, bought them out, shut them down to claim their market share for themselves for Kraft marshmallow cream. But in the 1960s, they realized there really wasn't enough money to be made in marshmallow cream and stopped sold off that division. But then eventually got wrapped. They purchased it accidentally back. So Jet Puffed marshmallow cream is a Kraft product, but they kind of don't market it with the same enthusiasm.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about the 100-year history of Fluff, but I'm going to posit that it has a century at least ahead of it. And one of the reasons why is because Fluff has been in space. Let's listen.
It's like opening the refrigerator. You got all your different stuff that you want to have. Drinks, meats, eggs, vegetables. And then we get some of our specialty stuff, some of our favorite stuff that your family can send up. In fact, I like Fluffernutters, and so I got sent up some fluff so I could make my Fluffernutter with peanut butter.
That's astronaut Sunny Williams, who took Fluff with her into space. I love that.
She makes a Fluffernutter before every one of her spacewalks. So she's got the record for number of spacewalks, and I attribute that to the power of Fluff.
Mimi Graney is the author of the book Fluff, the sticky sweet story of an American icon. She's also the founder of Somerville's annual What the Fluff Festival, coming up this September. We spoke with her back in March. And that's it for our special hour with some of our favorite inventors and their inventions. And this last thought, I hope we can all continue to create, to innovate, and to strive for improvement when it comes to America's best invention, our own great democratic experiment. Have a very happy and safe 4th of July. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.